Usually, radio announcements merely recommend a product, but this station provides its clients with a special service.
You are listening to the Faces for Radio podcast.
Fun and information are two sides to this podcast.
Here's Pat Egan.
Now that's a face for radio.
Welcome into the Faces of Radio podcast. I am your host, Pat Egan. This is the first episode of the Faces for Radio podcast. And basically the premise is we're going to interview people in sports about their career and their life. And how they got into the industry, how they are where they are right now, what they think about the current landscape of the sport that they're in. And joining me today is a special guest. If you're a Flyers fan and you listen to the radio or you watch them for years on TV, it is Steve Coates. Steve, how are you?
Great, Pat. How about you?
Oh, another day in paradise, my man. Another day.
I understand that.
All right. So, look, I want to talk to you about your career and also the Flyers team in general. You're a guy who, when I've been watching hockey in this town for years, and you've just kind of always been there. But where did you get your start? Like, how did you get into hockey? I understand you're from Canada, but like, who got you into the sport?
In other words, where the heck did he come from?
Yeah, I mean, kind of. Look, Steve Coates has been like a staple in this town, but you're kind of an enigma. I just feel like not a lot of people know exactly where you've come from. So I don't mean to pull. Tell me about your childhood, but tell me about your childhood.
I'm going to give you the Reader's Digest version. I came from Toronto, Ontario. I went to Michigan Tech University on a hockey scholarship, and then when I graduated, I wasn't a very good college player, and I had an opportunity. Through a fellow that I played junior hockey with, his father was the director of scouting for the Philadelphia Flyers. So when I came out of college, I said, well, I got to try to maybe go to a pro camp. And I got the opportunity through Alex Davids, who at that time was the director of scouting. So I came here in 1973. I was the shortest guy at training camp, which you could relate to because you're not the tallest guy I've ever met.
And so can your partner, Tim Saunders.
Yeah, we can throw him under the bus also on this. But and so in 1973, I came here just trying to maybe get a couple of years of pro hockey under my belt. I was young. I wanted to have some fun. And I played 7 years, but predominantly in the minors. Played a little bit. Well, I played 5 games in the National Hockey League in Detroit. I was there for a cup of coffee. And the rest of the time I was in, well, I spent a lot of time with the farm teams of the Philadelphia Flyers. And then from there, I used to kind of just mimic broadcasters. And in 1980, at the advent of cable television, they split the broadcast here in Philadelphia. Bobby Taylor and Gene Hart were doing the broadcast, and they needed a radio color analyst for 30 games at home with Gene Hart because Doc Emmerich, of course, now the number one probably play-by-play guy in the nation with NBC, he was going to be the play-by-play guy along with Bobby Taylor and Eddie Van Impe on TV, the 30 Prism games. So that's how I started. So I say the best way to describe it is right spot, right time, and I've been doing it ever since in different areas as far as whether it be Channel 57, Channel 29, WIP Radio, The Fanatic, all these different things. Of course, Comcast Sportsnet, all those different elements over 37 years.
So you went to Michigan Tech, and your story kind of reminds me of another Michigan Tech guy, John Scott.
Yeah, coming out of nowhere.
Yeah, he came out of nowhere and he worked hard and he got his shot. And obviously, a couple of years ago, he was in the All-Star game. But it must be something in the water up there.
Very well, Michigan Tech is probably the most famous player ever come out of Michigan Tech was Tony Esposito. Probably the most well-known player that ever played for the Flyers for Michigan Tech would be Lou Angotti, who was the first captain. It's a unique place because there's 4,000 guys and 300 girls. So if you don't play hockey, I mean, you better be an engineer. That's what it was. It's an engineering school, but it's a great hockey school. And
that's
275 inches of snow.
That's a bad ratio for you, Coatsy.
Real bad. No, real bad. But I was there to play hockey. I mean, I wouldn't have changed anything. I wouldn't have changed anything as far as looking back at it. But I've been very, very blessed that how this all turned out. Right spot, right time.
All right, so you said you played five games with the Detroit Red Wings. What year was that?
1977.
Now, was Gordie Howe on that team?
No, he was not. No. I missed Mark Howe by a year. That wasn't a very good team in Detroit that year, and I didn't help it.
I love your honesty with it. How many points did you get in that season?
I had with the five games.
Yep.
Oh, I think I had just the one goal, and I think I had 25 penalty minutes, and I tore a groin, and fired the puck into the corner on a breakaway from the blue line, and the crowd went from a yay to a boo in the same breath when I did it.
You know, Coatsy, I'd love to rip you for that. I had a game the other probably a week and a half ago where I missed on an empty net, and I was probably 10 feet away from it. So, can't blame you there. But look, you scored one goal. You scored one goal, yep. Which is a lot more than many, many people on this earth. Do you remember vividly scoring that goal?
Yep, absolutely. I remember exactly where it was. It was in the Olympia in Detroit. I got a puck in the slot, and we were playing the Pittsburgh Penguins, and I was just lucky enough to be in the right spot at the right time there, too. And I fired it by the goalie, and wasn't any flamboyant or anything like that. It was just very lucky.
Now, did you sell it hard, or were you kind of in shock?
Well, I was happy for a lot of reasons. I got a goal in the National Hockey League at a time that had been really struggling because I'd been there for a month and a half. I pulled because of the pulled groin, so I didn't have an opportunity to play. And my dad was there to see it. He had come down from Toronto.
Oh, that's awesome.
And then after that, the next year, the coach that brought me in got fired. They brought in a new general manager, Ted Lindsay, new coach. I was sent to Kansas City, and I would say that my career went south pretty quickly after that.
And where's the puck today?
Downstairs on a table beside my recliner. No fanfare.
So look, today in today's day and age, call-ups can sometimes be used for viral sensation. Teams will tape a guy's call-up, or they'll tape a guy calling his parents and telling them he's going to the National Hockey League. What was your situation? How did you learn that you were getting the call-up for the first time?
Well, I was playing with the Flyers farm team. I was the captain of the Flyers farm team in Springfield, the Springfield Indians at the time. And interestingly enough, my neighbor was Al Hill, and Al Hill was the one that got the call-up to Philadelphia that year to score the most points in the history of a rookie in the National Hockey League against the St. Louis Blues. And I was kind of ticked that I didn't get the opportunity to be called up. But anybody that was playing in the minors, you say, well, I'm going to be the guy. But Al got the opportunity in about, I don't remember how long, but it was a couple of, it might have been a couple of weeks or it could have been a month. I got the phone call from Larry Wilson, who was the coach of the Detroit Red Wings at the time, saying that I'd been traded there with Terry Murray, Bob Ritchie, Dave Kelly for Rick LaPointe and Mike Corney. I was the and in that trade. You know, like, okay, Terry Murray, Bob Ritchie, Dave Kelly, and Steve Coates. And I got the call that night in Springfield, and we were on a plane the next morning to Detroit. We played against Buffalo the first night. I ripped my groin that night. That's where I got off to a real bad start. We get on the plane, went to New York, and I went to the trainer. I was terrified because I told him, I said, I can't go. There's just no way in the world. I ripped my groin. I'm done. I can't. So I took 2 weeks off, and they were giving me a lot of heat to play because I had been traded there. So I played against the Islanders, and that's when I ripped my groin again on the breakaway. So my time there was not a good one. I got an opportunity to come back and did score the goal. I played five games, I guess, including Pittsburgh twice, Buffalo. Took the warm up against the Canadians, but I couldn't go because I was just trying to see if my groin was all right. Was not a good time, but that's exactly the way it happened.
Were you intimidated at all stepping foot into an NHL locker room?
No, because I'd already played for the preseason games for the Philadelphia Flyers. So it wasn't that very year too. So it wasn't Was it intimidating? Yes, intimidating to the fact that you're in a new area with a new group of people. You know, if I had come into the Philadelphia, you know, I'd been in training camp for 4 years before going to the minors. So I was friends with everybody. I spent my summers here. So that would have been less intimidating. Going to Detroit and meeting a whole new group of people, guys that I'd played against in the minors, of course. There was probably, you know, five or six of them that are guys that I played against in the American Hockey League back in the day. So, but no, it's a wonderful experience, but it was a wonderful experience for a day for me until I ripped my groin.
Now, you said you had about 25 penalty minutes. It sounds like you were kind of an agitator, kind of a fighter. And then you just said that you played against some of these guys. Had you fought some of these guys that you played against, and now you have to be teammates with them?
Did I fight anybody on that Detroit Red Wings team? No. No. In the National Hockey League, I fought. Oh, my goodness. I just went blank on his name. I fought twice, once against the Penguins and once against the Islanders. And then when I was with the Flyers in preseason, I fought Terry O'Reilly in Boston and Paul McIntosh in Buffalo.
Well, you didn't exactly go for the lightweights, did you, Coatsy?
You couldn't. You couldn't do that. That's one thing about... In those days, you better come to protect yourself and probably be a little bit more energetic and more proactive. That way, you get a lot more room.
Now,
but in those days, you had to do something silly once, and then you'd get a little bit more room.
Yeah.
No matter what or how big you were.
Now, you must have had it, though, before where you get a guy that gets traded, to whether it would be in the minors or, you know, the five games in the NHL or an independent league team, where you know, the team makes a move, they acquire a guy, or maybe that guy is you get traded to a team, and, you know, there's a guy on the team that you just don't like, you haven't liked playing against for whatever reason. Did you have that happen? And if so, is that an awkward situation that, you know, like you get traded to a team and, oh crap, I got to play with, you know, fill in the blank, this guy now?
That's an interesting question. And as you just brought that up, I just thought of somebody and it was right in front of me and I just saw him. That's really interesting that you brought that up. I've never had anybody ask that before. Dennis Polansch was the captain of the Red Wings and I fought him about 3-4 times when he was with the Virginia Red Wings. I forgot about Polo. And I just ran into Polo in Calgary. It was like an old homecoming because, for some reason in this business, as much as you can fight a guy during a game, there's some kind of allegiance. I don't think you put your finger on it, but I don't think there's a lot of people in the game that all like Dave Schultz would be mad at, you know, Terry Riley the rest of his life, or Ben Wilson. I don't think that carries over. I think it's just it's there, and it's kind of like a badge of honor that you had that ability to do that. Because Polanich, I don't know if you remember Polanich, he was a little fire puck too, and he was a tough little guy. But we became teammates, and that was no big deal.
So how is the game different today? I've talked to former players who played during your era, and I remember one in particular, and I'm not going to name his name, but it was during it was heading towards the last NHL lockout, and to me he seemed very bitter. He basically said that these guys make too much money now. They need to limit everything. They need to limit how much the teams can spend, but also how much the players make. And I kind of heard it like he was a little bit bitter the fact that he didn't make that much, as much as these players make today. Do you sense that with the former players that you talk to, your former teammates? Do you have that feeling yourself that the players get paid too much and maybe you should have made more during your time?
Well, you certainly can't begrudge the people that are playing now for what they're making. I mean, the system is different. The game is different. There's a lot more teams. So obviously the whole dynamic of the sport of hockey has changed. You can't begrudge it. Sometimes you say to yourself, oh boy, it'd be great to make this kind of money. But at the same time, there's such a different attitude about the whole thing, and what I would never trade anything about it. I mean, it's no big deal. I mean, my first year I made what, $300 a week playing in Des Moines, Iowa. My next year I made $15,000. The most I made was Detroit. I made $35,000. I thought I was living pretty good. So there's no way in the world I could look back at the 7 years that I played in the minors, my whole 7 years, except for that short period of time. There's no, it's just a whole different dynamic. So you can't complain about it. I've heard some older players say, well, you know, they should be taken care of and all that. But that's just a rumbling, but I don't think it's a big deal.
Now, how is the game different today? Like, do you think guys, like, could Gordie Howe be as dominant today in today's game with the composite sticks? Could he be as dominant today as he was back in the day? You know, and the list goes on with those guys, but how would it transition with the greatest players of all time back then to today's game?
It'd be very hard to compare because of the speed of the game. It'd be very hard to compare because of the equipment being so much better. The rules are so much different that a Gordie Howe wouldn't be able to do what he did because of the game being a lot more vanilla. The game was a game of intimidation, of which he was a huge part. I don't think he can make that. Pat, I don't think you can make that comparison. I think that the skilled players at that time were skilled within the game itself. But this game today is so wide open. They're so much faster. They're so much bigger. In the same size rink, but they don't have the same type of attitude that was present in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, where it was a little bit more of a rodeo, if you know what I mean.
Yep.
And you had to be a little bit, you had to have a lot of grit to play the game at that time. I don't think you have to have that same grit on a continual basis. But to make that comparison, that's really, really hard. Really hard, because there's so many different factors that come into play.
You mentioned a big part of Gordie Howe's game was intimidation. Should fighting be allowed in hockey?
I was a proponent of that for so long about the fact, you know, I had those T-shirts saying, Coatsy's right, let him fight. Because I've always believed that the game of hockey has to be policed in the 200-by-85 area. That way it keeps everybody honest on the ice surface. Everybody's honest on the ice surface, because if you do something to my teammate, I'll protect that teammate, and we're going to make sure that you don't do it again. And then put that in the back of everybody's mind, and that was a big part of the game, to understand what you could do and what you couldn't do on the ice. Since the league has taken over the policing by fining and suspending, we've seen a different type of rulemaking. And now that fighting has, let's say, diminished to a minimal amount of fights, the play of different individuals has changed a little bit. They might take a little bit more, let's say, blatant shots at somebody, because they don't have to worry about somebody beating the heck out of them. All they're going to do is get suspended or have money taken from them. The other thing that's taken away is the shield. The shield, it's just kind of saying, okay, yeah, I'm going to fight a guy with a shield. Doesn't make very much sense. You can't take your helmet off to fight. So I'm kind of in a quagmire about, do I like fighting? Do I want fighting in the game? Yeah, I do. But now with so much equipment and the helmets and the masks, it just becomes like, why do you want to do it? Now, you still have to have an avenue to vent your anger. I always say, people say, well, what do you think about fighting? Why is there fighting in the game? Well, listen, if you go to work, I said to a guy one day, I said, what are you, a doctor? He goes, yeah. I said, do you like all the people you work with? Not really. Well, what about if you had the opportunity to beat the hell out of a guy and go sit in the corner for 5 minutes? Wouldn't that really kind of release a lot of the anger in the workplace, and then we'd be fine? He goes, yeah, that'd be great. I said, that's why we have fighting. And it's a necessary thing to keep everybody honest on the ice, and the spinoff is the entertainment value. But I still think now, I don't know if it can go anywhere, because they don't want it. There's people that don't want it in the game. And with the shields, I don't think it's possible anymore.
Is the NHL using the concussion problem that you've seen in the NFL and in the NHL, are they using that as somewhat propaganda to get fighting out of the game?
I don't know if it'd be propaganda. I would think it'd be actually a reality that because of the safety for the players, that that's a big problem.
Well, the reason I say it is because there was a documentary that I watched, I think called Ice Guardians, and they brought up that a lot of the concussions in the NHL aren't actually from fighting, and a lot of the guys here that have retired because of concussion problems weren't what you consider enforcers. And a lot of the concussions happened basically just from being jarred from a hit. So, you know, on the surface, you say, all right, it makes sense. If you're getting punched in the head, you're going to get a concussion. But after watching the documentary, it changed my opinion on the matter.
So, are you saying that you feel that it's a necessary thing to get rid of it because concussions are a major problem within the business?
In my opinion, I think the NHL is using the concussions as an excuse to get rid of fighting when fighting isn't the issue. Fighting isn't leading to as many concussions as they'd like to lead you to believe.
Only the NHL knows the answer to that. But when you take a look, like for us, we just thought we were hungover. I mean, you had a headache or you didn't feel good. You never told anybody that you had anything like that. You just went and played. We didn't wear helmets. So we can't make a comparison. And for me, I was small. So I don't know how many I had, but I know that I had more than a couple. And I actually fractured my skull my last year of college with a helmet on. So looking back at it, what's the big, like, I took the risk of playing hockey. How can I blame anybody for a concussion or any concussion problems that I might have? I mean, it's a very strange situation where this medical find has now really affected football and hockey especially. And I don't know where it's going to go down the road. I know the football players are going to get a deal, and probably the hockey players are going to get a deal down the road, depending upon how many games you play in the National Hockey League. But I don't know where it goes down the road as far as future liability, but certainly I bet you that it's in every conversation that fighting is a big part of the problem with concussions. When you look at the way they go with trying to kind of zoom in on the guys that were big-time fighters in the National Hockey League who have passed away.
Cudsy, what are the biggest changes you've seen in your time from players you played with to players nowadays? And I'm not just talking like size and skill and speed and all that, but like the mentality. Is there a difference in the mentality of today's players than there were in yesteryear?
Has to be. No, there's no two ways about it. There's guys that the mentality is, it's not the player's fault what the mentality being different, because this is the way they've been brought up. The game has changed. The mentality has changed. The whole environment around hockey. It starts in minor hockey where you can't hit until you're 12 years old. You can't do this. You can't do that. So the environment of the game of hockey has completely changed growing up, what they're taught, how they're taught. There's a lot more systems taught when they're kids now. There's a lot more technical ability. There's a lot more, as I mentioned before, the equipment's better. I could go on and on and on about the differences. So the difference in the game now as compared to what it was when I played, it's like huge. It's just absolutely huge. The only thing's the same, is the puck's the same. The sticks obviously are different. But and I don't really like the sticks. I wish we had stayed with wood, because that's just the game. That's the way the game is. And that'd be another question and another argument for another day about whether the game's a better game because the puck goes faster, or that the players go faster. The sticks are light. I mean, the sticks are so light now, it's unbelievable. And so it's not fair to make a comparison between what we talked about before, like a Gordie Howe that had a stick that was a lot heavier than that stick. So I don't know how good Gordie would have been with this stick, or how good Gordie would have been with all these lighter skates and not breaking down. Skates used to break down because they were leather. Now they're another composite type thing, but they're just so good, these skates, it's unbelievable. So it's really hard to make these comparisons. Really, really tough. You could get into some great arguments about who's the better player, what would this, could you think, would the 1975 Philadelphia Flyers be able to beat, you know, the 2016 Pittsburgh Penguins? It'd be a great thing to try to make a comparison in, you know, over a couple of beers, but I don't know. You can't make that comparison.
One of the things that I love about hockey, and, you know, it's funny because I just saw a video on a guy who's 95 in Duluth, Michigan, or Duluth, Minnesota, still playing hockey. And now I was talking to my mom about this, too. It's really the only sport where you see former players still playing hockey. Like, years after they retire, they'll still strap on the skates. When was the last time you strapped on some skates and you know, slapped the puck around?
Probably 10 years ago now. And then I used to put the skates on, of course, for doing Coach's Corners. But when my knees started to go, it just became tough and tougher. And guys like Joe Watson, Bob Kelly, I mean, they're all my age. Joe Watson's probably 72 years old, and he's still playing. Bob Kelly's my age. He's still playing. So it's really hard to make that, like, you come to a point in your life, like, I'm 67 now, and you come to a point in your life, you just can't do it anymore. But it is a very unique game where, I mean, I got a lot of friends that are 60, 61, 62 years old, still put the skates on. Mickey Redman, Hall of Famer. With the Detroit Red Wings, the color analyst for the Red Wings, he's 71, and he just absolutely loves still playing hockey for the Detroit Red Wings alumni.
Do you miss it?
Oh, yeah, every day. Every day. I'll tell you what, Bobby Clark had one of the greatest comments ever for a former player. If he said, if you had one thing you could do now that you're sitting here and you've been retired 4 or 5 years, what's the one thing you'd like to do? And he said, I'd like to have one more shift in a Flyers uniform. That's just kind of just to be able to play, to do it again. That's like at a professional level, not like going out and playing a charity game or like that. That's what it's about. Because and most players will tell you, I would say 95% of the players that ever played the game will tell you that the one thing that, not the game, but the players and the guys being in the locker room every day, day after day after day, that is what you miss the most.
Oh, yeah.
And that's one of the biggest adjustments that you make after playing hockey, because you don't have that anymore. You don't have that camaraderie. You don't have the support of so many people.
Oh, my wife can't figure out why I stay at the rink till 1 a.m. It's like...
Well, have her call me.
I'll make sure to do that for you. Look, all those years in the minors, you must have some wild stories. I've read books from hockey players like Jeremy Roenick and stuff. And the best stories they have are usually from the minors, from traveling to these podunk towns on the buses. Can you share some of the wild stories that you've encountered throughout the years?
Can I share?
Well, I should say, will you share? I know you can do it. Are you willing to do it?
There's so many, Pat. There isn't one above the other. It would take a whole, if you sat down and started talking, you'd have to have, like, what happened in Des Moines, Iowa? What happened in Richmond, Virginia? What happened? I mean, there's so many wild stories.
Well, give me one from Des Moines.
Oh, Des Moines. Des Moines, you know, that's not a... See, it's hard. My first year pro in Des Moines, those years in Des Moines was a really indicative of at that time of what you saw in Slapshot. No difference whatsoever. The only difference between Slapshot and what we went through is that we didn't have a car racing set in one of the hotel rooms. But when it came to bench emptying brawls and being on a bus, off a bus, it was absolutely a rodeo night after night after night. I got to tell you this, though. All those guys in Slapshot that came out, all the tough guys that came out on the blue line at the end, you remember they said, okay, we're going to bring in the big tough guys for that final game?
Yeah. They brought the Chief and Oglethorpe. And
yeah, those guys were the real deal. Blake Ball, Ogie Oglethorpe, that wasn't Billy Goldthorpe, but Ogie Oglethorpe was a guy named Bill Goldthorpe. He played for the Syracuse Eagles. And that's where they got that. Ogie Oglethorpe was Billy Goldthorpe. And let me tell you right now, that was a shit show. You had to pay attention to the warm-up. He'd hit you right over the head in the warm-up. And all those guys that were on that blue line were real players, except for the two actors.
Let me ask you, were you with the Flyers when the Russians came?
I was in the minors in Springfield. I watched that on TV.
What was the reaction? What was the reaction to players when you've got, you know, Tretiak coming over and a bunch of names that I can't pronounce and probably forgotten a long time ago. You know, they come over here. They're the most dominant team in the world, and the Flyers take it to them.
Well, first of all, it was an interesting dynamic when you look back at it now, because in those days, the Russians used to send over two teams. They had Moscow Dynamo, and the Russian Nationals would come over, and some other teams. That would be a moneymaker for the minor league teams, both in the Central Hockey League, the American Hockey League, where we'd play the Russians. I mean, that went on for years, and it was a very popular thing because there was a built-in animosity between the Russians and anybody that was here. Obviously, it reached a plateau when it was an interesting dynamic. The Philadelphia Flyers were basically the bad boys of the National Hockey League then, because they had changed the dynamic of how the game was played with their fifth. So when the Flyers took on the Russians, the Russians were beating the heck out of everybody. So nobody thought that the Flyers were going to be able to beat the Russians. So when the Flyers beat the Russians, all of a sudden it was like the National Hockey League loved the Philadelphia Flyers, because they had put, obviously, the NHL on the national hockey map. They had done something that nobody else had done and beat the Russians. And it was just a complete different dynamic. And they were doing something completely different as far as, you know, their national team were all professionals, but yet they were going around beating everybody, you know, in the Olympics and everything like that because of their abilities. And their tactics and the way they played the game were completely opposite, where we were always taught to go north-south, 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 never go backwards, where they were kind of frustrating to play, where they would just come up into the neutral zone, and if they didn't like what they saw, they'd go back. And they wouldn't shoot the puck. They would use the pass. They would pass, and they would pass. And they would do everything in their power to be able to keep the puck away from you. They would frustrate you. And it really created a lot of tension on the ice when it happened. But they also did a lot of things differently. They didn't shower. They would put grease on their bodies to make sure they preserved their energies and they wouldn't lose their energy. They had a lot of strange things, but it created an animosity between the Russians and the Americans and the Canadians. And when it came to a head with that Philadelphia game, it changed the whole dynamic of hockey.
Oh, that's fascinating. You obviously do the radio for the Flyers now with Tim Saunders. Who is your favorite player to watch on the current Flyers team?
Right now?
Yep. They've won 7 of 8. They're one of the hottest teams in the NHL after losing 10 in a row. But who's the favorite right now?
My favorite player, I don't think. I can honestly tell you that every player has a different thought process for me in watching the game. I mean, I've always been the type of guy that likes a player that's going to play the game in a tough way, in a physical way, but still bring the skill level. And when you take a look at, like, the guys that go to the corner, Wayne Simmonds is probably, if you're going to line up everybody in a row and say, okay, who's the guy that represents the Flyer logo the best? It would be Wayne Simmonds, because he brings it every night. He plays the game hard. It doesn't matter who he plays with. He plays the same. He makes them better. He produces. He brings the physicality to your hockey club. So that's the guy. Would be Wayne Simmonds.
Do you think that the Flyers should trade Wayne Simmonds, though?
No, absolutely not. I think that, obviously, there's a problem when you have money coming into play. His contract's going to come up, and maybe the contract's going to be worth more than he's going to be worth at that time. But I'd be willing to take that chance, considering the fact that Wayne Simmonds played hurt all last year. One of the reasons that I don't like the rules of coming out and saying that a player is injured, not saying what's wrong with him, upper body, lower body injury. So everybody becomes critical of the player because they don't know if he's hurt or not. So as a result, Wayne Simmonds came out at the end of the year and said, well, I was hurt all season. Everybody expected it, but at the same time, it's not fair to the player. I think Wayne Simmonds is still the prototypical Philadelphia Flyers player, the way he plays. And I would love to see him in this lineup, especially now with Van Riemsdyk coming in here. Provides a lot more upended, upfront type offense in those top two lines, which I think Wayne Simmons certainly deserves to be part of.
You know, a lot of fans out there would disagree with you. They just say that you should sell high on him, kind of like what they did with Braden Shen, and get something for him while you can before he leaves. But my contention is that the impact in the locker room would affect the team in a negative way to the point where it's not worth it. So you're around the team every day. Can you talk to just Wayne Simmons as a locker room guy?
Well, I think it's probably a lot easier to talk about Wayne Simmons as a hockey player and what he provides as a team player. I mean, he brings it every night. He'll drop the gloves for his team when need be, plays the game physically, plays in the areas that are what we call the dirty areas at both ends of the ice, probably one of the top guys in the power play as far as the area in front of the net. All the different things that make you a good team guy. And nobody knows better than the same players that are sitting in that locker room how good the team is when they look around the room and say, yeah, we got Drew, we got Voracek, we got Simmons. And Simmons makes everybody a little bit tougher. Understand that. When you have the grit of a Wayne Simmons, makes everybody feel a little bit safer when they go on the ice because they know that they got him on the hockey club. So for the people that say, well, yeah, let's keep moving around and trade up and look for the future, well, how long do you want to wait? You got an opportunity here to get better next year, score more goals, get a guy like Wayne Simmons in his prime, and worry about things down the road. I mean, everybody wants to be it's really good to be a backseat driver, but understand that the guys come to play every night to win, and to have a Wayne Simmons on your team is very important.
All right, now moving on just to the league itself, this last Stanley Cup was incredible because, you know, Ovechkin finally gets his first long-awaited Stanley Cup. The Vegas Golden Knights go right from expansion to the Stanley Cup in their first season. Do you think that is good for the NHL?
No. No. It obviously brought an awful lot of attention to it, but I think it brings a lot of question to whether the expansion process for the Vegas Knights was a little bit too lenient or too advantageous for them. It also questions the philosophies of a lot of teams in the National Hockey League. I mean, is it better to just build a team that's got four strong lines, three good sets of defense, and an outstanding goalie to be competitive on a night-to-night basis? With the upside potential of making the Stanley Cup, maybe, as compared to having $8 million players, $7 million players, and have your team all front-end loaded. Those are the questions that came up when you've got the Las Vegas Golden Knights going to the Stanley Cup final in their first year. So now what you do? What do you do now with Seattle coming in? What's your draft process going to be then? Everybody in Seattle is expecting their team probably go to the Stanley Cup finals the first year.
Yeah.
So no, I think it's good. I think it's good that it brings people the attention to the underdog is a great – it's always a great draw of fans. Always.
Yeah.
It's a super magnet.
I remember friends of mine saying about, you know, how amazing the Golden Knights was, and I said, well, it's morally impacted because there's a salary cap now, and the last time we had expansion in the NHL, there wasn't a salary cap, so teams are dumping their high-level guys like a Marc-Andre Fleury, who they can't afford anymore. And the Vegas Golden Knights were able to kind of exploit the salary cap situation and take to task the teams that weren't good at it and get better players. And
yeah, I'm not taking away from the fact that George McPhee did a great job as a general manager there. I mean, they did a heck of a job building that hockey club, and they had a lot of things to hang their hat on. They were called the team not going to be able to be competitive and a team that was expected to be poor, like past expansion teams. When the Washington Capitals came into the league, they set a record for losses that was like embarrassing. But this was a completely different thing, and they built on their togetherness as a group. They built on all of a sudden their success in the early going, and they never looked back. And I think that had a lot to do with their success. But I don't think it was good for the other 30 teams to look back and say, wow, a new team can get together and all of a sudden they're that successful. If you take a look at Washington winning it, two things that were really important. The one thing probably that is way above everything else is Ovechkin arrived. The Ovechkin that the Washington Capitals were waiting for, the guy that just took charge of everything, played the game hard, plays the game heavy, obviously one of the premier goal scorers ever to play in the National Hockey League, but he led that hockey club. But the guy who was second, in my mind, oh yeah, they had a lot of good scoring with the Burakovskys and the Backstroms and all these players. But the bottom line is that Tommy Wilson played a huge part in that game, or that win for the Washington Capitals throughout the series. He set the tone, saying, boys, you want to play us? We're going to go out there. We're going to play the game physical. Keep your head up because we're going to win the cup. And he was a very big part of that.
All right. Now, sticking with the expansion situation, you mentioned that Seattle's probably 99% sure going to be the next team. Do you have any ideas on how to kind of stop a situation like the Vegas Golden Knights, like them just kind of exploiting the cap situation and creating a team of, you know, misfit toys, if you will, but also very good players, and how the NHL is able to keep them from not necessarily being a bad team, but not being this good right away?
Well, the cap is obviously one of the reasons, but the other reason were the rules that were set in stone or set that were different than the past expansions. That's the other thing you've got to look at. So are they going to leave the rules for this expansion the same as the other expansions in prior years in the National Hockey League? The National Hockey League had probably one of the most, I don't even know how you would call, I guess the most unique expansion when they originally expanded from 6 to 12 teams in 1967. I mean, to add 6 teams in 1 year is just absolutely amazing. And they did it. Obviously, there was a huge imbalance with Flyers, St. Louis, Minnesota, Pittsburgh, Oakland, Los Angeles coming into the National Hockey League. And that's why St. Louis, they always say, well, St. Louis went to the Stanley Cup Finals in their first year. Well, they represented the Western Conference. That's why. So the Western Conference winner played the Eastern Conference winner, and that's how they ended up in the Stanley Cup Final. It wasn't even close. But in this time, obviously, one of the deals, they wanted to make Vegas a lot more competitive as compared to past expansion teams. It worked, and then it worked better than they thought it was going to work. So the rules are what's going to be looked at and be very interesting, because Seattle's going to probably go, well, hold on for a second. Vegas got that. Why don't we get that? So that'll be a story for another day.
Are you a fan of the expansion, or do you think that the NHL should actually ratchet back some teams from, let's say, Florida and Phoenix and just markets that have never really embraced the game?
Well, you know, it's all about money. I mean, it is a business. We could be a purist and sit back and say, yeah, we'd like to have 24 teams and really, you know, do a good job in the markets we are cultivating. But the bottom line is the owners are in there to make money. They've had huge money put into individual franchises to make money. That's what they are. They're businessmen. And they make a lot of money when they let a new team in. Like, I think that the Seattle teams could be up into the $600 million range. That's a lot of money. So when you take that into consideration, if it's working, fine. Are there teams that are suffering? Yeah, but they'll weed themselves out over time, just like the Oakland Seals did and the Cleveland Barons and all these teams that just couldn't keep up with the competitiveness of the National Hockey League to put people in their building. Quebec Nordiques were one. The Winnipeg Jets on the first end of it. Atlanta, twice it happened. So the business element will weed them out in the long run. Is it a black eye in any league when you lose teams? Yeah, but it's all part of the business element, I think.
Yeah, looking at the job that Gary Bettman has done, you talk about the fact that, you know, he is a businessman and he is working for the owners to make them the most money, but at times I feel like he can't see the forest through the trees. And a prime example is when Pittsburgh wasn't doing well, he was thinking about moving the team to Kansas City. And as a hockey fan, you sit there and you go, hold on a second, Pittsburgh would probably be a pretty good market. They just need players, which they eventually got, and they sold out and won cups. But is Kansas City really going to embrace hockey the way it was, or is Kansas City just throwing money at the situation? And when I look at Phoenix, that is a team that it didn't make sense right from the get-go. I feel like they used the logic from Slapshot. You know, all these retirees go to Phoenix and they want hockey.
and it just hasn't worked. So why wouldn't you look to move that to maybe a Seattle, or if not Seattle, maybe back to Quebec?
Because you don't make the expansion money. As I mentioned, that's $600 million. So they'd rather give out an expansion franchise, which is business again.
Yeah, but you're losing money, though, with Phoenix pretty much every single year.
Well, that's it. That's microeconomics as compared to macroeconomics. Let's get back to, first of all, your conversation about Gary Bettman. Gary Bettman has been a commissioner in the National Hockey League since 93-94. He just got inducted, or is being inducted, into the Hockey Hall of Fame, and deservingly so. I mean, I'd be lying to you if I agree with everything he does, but he's grown this league immensely. I got a bigger TV contract, got a lot more players, I mean, a lot more teams in the league. It's now a major part. It used to be that the NHL was fourth, and they're still fourth. But still, it's now more competitive for the National Hockey League as far as the big business about sports. And so I think that he, in the long run, when you sit back and try to understand his legacy as a commissioner, it's one that has been one of great success.
All right, now this
now,
is
if you want it.
Go ahead.
Now, if you want to take a look at the micro is Arizona. Back in the day, they had a team called the Phoenix Roadrunners there. It was in the World Hockey, before that in the Central Hockey League, and they played in a building downtown called the Coliseum. And it was a really good building, about 9,000, and they drew very well, both in the Central League and the World Hockey Association. And everybody thought it'd be a great market. When they went there, they made two mistakes. The first mistake, and this is being a backseat driver myself right now, just an opinion. I imagine a lot of people in Phoenix would disagree with what I'm about to say. But they first went to Phoenix to play in the arena downtown that was for the Phoenix Suns. The building was designed like the one in the Barclays Center in New York with the Brooklyn, where it's a basketball arena. So you only had the use of three sides of the stadium. And actually, the one end of the arena went up underneath the stands. So people at that end would watch a monitor, and their heads would go up and down as compared to a tennis match going back and forth. Mistake number one, they went to a building that was really not conducive for hockey, and it didn't hurt them because they drew well, but it didn't help them because they weren't getting the first use of the facility, or the best use of the facility. So what they did is they went out and they said, okay, we're going to get a new owner, and we're going to move it. And instead of what everybody – You did a survey tomorrow. Everybody said the building had to go to Scottsdale. Scottsdale was the key. Scottsdale was the area that was going to draw the most people. Scottsdale was the biggest area that could support it, and also the closest to the arena where people would come. Instead, they built in Glendale, and it's 35 minutes from everybody, and people just don't want to go. And as a result, the building is so far away that they can't survive. That's not saying Phoenix can't support a hockey team. I truly believe they can. It's just because the building is in the wrong spot for people to come.
That's interesting you say that. I was out in Phoenix, and I was told basically it's about a 45-minute drive from where we were to go to a game, and that was puzzling to me because in Philadelphia, you know, you're pretty much 20 minutes away from the Wells Fargo Center. I kind of want to get back into Bettman with you because I respectfully disagree. And it's interesting because you're in the sport. You know, I'm a spectator, I'm a fan, and you're actually in it. But from a fan's perspective, looking at the legacy of Gary Bettman, I see a guy who has gone through three lockouts, has canceled a season once, took what I think was actually a bad TV deal with the Outdoor Life Network, and it ended up being NBC. But the reason I say that was because you didn't take lesser money to stay on ESPN, which is the worldwide leader in sports. Now ESPN's hockey coverage is basically Barry Melrose in a bad suit. And in that aspect, I don't know how much he's actually done to grow the game. I think that he just kind of took the most money with that TV deal instead of actually wisely going with a place like ESPN.
Well, when you take a look at the TV itself, back in the day, national television receipts for individual teams could have been maybe $2 million each. There was no money in national television. Now the national television deal is $200 million, and they're expecting it to be $500 million the next time around in a year. That's growth. That's growth. And the growth of the National Hockey League allows the national television stations to be that much more embracing to the league because there is coverage throughout North America. They have expanded to areas. Now, are they still in their growth stage? Yeah. Are they as successful you'd like them to see? Probably not. But the expansion of the National Hockey League since Gary Bettman has come in has been spectacular. And the success of exposing the game, having Stanley Cup final games on national television, is 100% better than it was back in 1993-94 when we had Fox covering it and having the puck going up in the stands. So, you know, we can disagree on the business growth, but just take a look at the amount of teams that have come into this league and the amount of success it's been and the number of expansion teams that have won Stanley Cups.
All right, fair enough, fair enough. But the NHL is still fourth, and many people would actually argue it's fifth. And we just saw the World Cup, and the ratings boost from the World Cup was incredible. I'm not a soccer guy myself, but it's hard to argue the fact that that is the sport in the world. But that sport that is number one in the world has had trouble kind of gaining a viewership in America. And I feel like the NHL has a similar situation where they're still fourth or fifth. And while I think it's arguably, if not the greatest game out there to watch right now, what do they need to do to kind of go from fourth or fifth to, let's say, second or third?
Well, I think the hardest part is that the game is it's kind of been searching for an identity, not searching for an identity, but you know, for years there's been the argument that people don't like fighting. And I'm not one that believes that because every time I see a fight in the National Hockey League, I see 18,000 people standing up and cheering.
Yeah, most of the time I hear people say they go to the games for fighting.
That's always been one of the subplots is that you could be getting beat 5-1, but there was a fight and go home and say, "Did you see that fight?" You get yourself into an argument here because a lot of advertisers representing a lot of surveys and a lot of people that don't like fighting. So they say, well, I don't want to advertise with a sport that has fighting. Then if you take a look at the concussion thing right now, which is creating a lot of problem and a lot of heat on a lot of sports about what you do about the head hunting and what you do about, you know, hits to the head. Well, it's really tough to defend fighting when people are worried about hits to the head and the guy's getting hit in the head about 4 or 5 times during a fight. So you really get yourself into a jam. And on top of that, you get yourself into a jam with hitting. And there's three things that make people stand up during a hockey game: scoring, hitting, and fighting. And I just brought up two that are kind of being pressured because of the concussion issue. And the players now are bigger, stronger. The equipment is so much better that all these different elements, when guys do hit now, it's a lot fiercer than it was 30 years ago. So all these different problems obviously then create, where's your entertainment value when those things aren't happening? And I think that's what the league's going through right now as far as it's a war, not a war, but it's a battle to be able to keep your core issues with your hockey the game, but still keeping the adversarial situation with the concussion. And I don't know where you go right now. This is a real battle that Gary Bettman's got himself into. And, you know, they've been trying to, you know, cut down on fighting for an awful long time because there was always that pressure that people, that there was all these fans that were out there that weren't coming to National Hockey League games because of fighting. And it'll be interesting to see how this game does grow with all these outside pressures.
All right, who's the best player in the NHL right now?
The best player in the National Hockey League, and I'm going to make a lot of Flyers fans mad at this, is Sidney Crosby. Okay. Very simple. Who do you want on your team to win and come to play night after night after night? And that's the guy you'd want. That's the guy I would pick if I was picking first pick right now to start a new team?
There's probably about 5 or 6 guys you could kind of throw in that conversation. And I'm going to go back to the issue with the NHL. Do they have a marketing issue? Because the NBA markets their stars extremely well. You know, LeBron James, everybody knows who LeBron James is, what he looks like. Sidney Crosby is a household name, but I feel like if he actually walked down the street in a lot of cities, he would just go unnoticed. So do they have a marketing issue?
I've never thought about that, to be honest with you. I've always felt that if you go on to all the different websites, I mean, you're going back again now to the recognizable or the recognizing of a NHL player as compared to a basketball player, football player, baseball player.
Yeah, like during if you watch during an NHL game, right?
Yeah,
you're not going to see a lot of commercials for Sidney Crosby. But if you watch an NBA game, you're going to see pretty much every other commercial is going to have an NBA player in it. And I feel like that helps the game build.
I can't really answer the question because I'm not a marketing expert. I know that with social media and all the different things that are going on right now, as far as the marketing of professional sports teams, that's become a huge part of it. Clicks, people clicking to find out what's going on, clicking to see who's doing what. So whether the league has fallen behind the other teams or the other leagues, I couldn't answer that. I would not be able to answer that question.
Okay, now back to the main team at hand, the Philadelphia Flyers. They have a lot of exciting prospects in their system. I think Ron Hextall's done a great job of retooling that farm club that has been, or farm system that's been pretty barren. What's one of the prospects are you most excited to see coming into training camp?
Well, I think the first thing you look at is that the maturation of your defense. I mean, this is a kind of the element that the team and Ron Hextall have been selling on about the fact that and he's done a great job. He's done a great job in developing and drafting and bringing these kids on. And now, you know, the Sanheims of this world and the Provorovs of this world have arrived to fill in with the Gosses Bears. I mean, this is an area when you take a look at the age and the amount of years now under their belt, that it's only going to get better and better. And with Sanheim coming into the forefront, Robert Haig, I mean, what a home run that was having him in the lineup. So that is something that if you have a strong defense, a defense could go out there and do a good job in the offensive zone, but obviously bottle people up in your own zone, do a good job protecting your goaltender. That just makes it just so much harder for other teams. And I think that's going to be a big part of the success of this hockey club. And what's the makeup going to be? Who's going to play with who? Who knows? There's so many, you know, combinations and permutations that can come up through both your forward lines and your defense during a season. That doesn't matter. It's all about what the team looks like, what the team's going to look like as a whole to be able to bring a good product. I think the second thing is that you finally get the big left winger that can come in and score goals. And that's something that Van Riemsdyk definitely brings. And it gives you a solid 2 scoring lines, which is pretty prototypical of what the league is now, because going back to what your comment is about the cap, you really don't have a middle class anymore. You have the high end because of the dollars. And then you have a third line that you'd like to be able to provide scoring, but basically becomes a checking, and then your fourth line is what they call the affectionate line of being the energy line.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, were you surprised that they brought Van Riemsdyk back?
No, I'm not. It used to be those days are gone. Where, oh, you don't want to do that. You can't. You know, you traded a player. It won't look good that you bring him back. Those days are gone. Because of the way it's a business, you can't let your head fall below your butt. You got to make a business decision, and he was the best guy available for what the Flyers needed. And the Flyers needed, and they've needed it for a while, was a big left winger, and they got it. And they got a guy with absolutely great hands, which is going to be a big plus to any center that he plays with, whether it be Couturier, whether it be Patrick. Who knows where it's going to be? But it's a big plus.
One of the names that pretty much every single Flyers, anytime we talk Flyers on the station, and I think it drives Jason crazy,
one of the names we always hear is, when is Carter Hart going to be ready? And Jason tries to alert these people, it's probably going to be 2 years. Can you just talk about the negative aspects of rushing a goalie, a top-level guy, a top prospect like Carter Hart, the negative impact that if you rush this guy and he fails, you know, he might never be the same again?
Steve Mason. Steve Mason came into the league right away, won a Calder Cup, and what has he done? Name me another goaltender that has jumped into the National Hockey League and be successful. There's been one. Came in with the Buffalo Sabres, won the Stanley Cup with the Pittsburgh Penguins. And I'm just having a little bit of a senior moment here on that right now.
I'm blanking. I mean, the only guy I think of is Ron Tugnutt from.
No, he came out as an 18-year-old high school player, and we'll think about it as we move along here. But there's a reason, and you go as far as the importance of the position or the how tough the position is. Forwards are usually, in the scheme of things, the easiest one to jump in from a lower rank to the National Hockey League. Second is the defense, and third is goalies. Goalies is the hardest position to play in the National Hockey League, and you've got to be able to put that that goaltender down in the minors to learn. Now, is it saying that if he comes in and does things that nobody's ever seen before? Well, then that changes the rules a little bit. But those rules are really stringent when it comes to young goalies. This kid was a phenom. He's done everything you could possibly do and possibly win up in Canada as far as his individual accomplishments as a goaltender. So obviously there's a lot of heat on him. And if you have an opportunity to talk to him, this kid's way ahead of his time as far as his maturation is concerned. So maybe stranger things have happened that he can do it. But percentage-wise, I'm going to go back to what Jason said. I think Jason's probably absolutely correct at anywhere like 1 to 2 years.
By the way, Tom Barrasso was the guy we couldn't think of.
Tommy Barrasso.
Another guy that did it was Carey Price, but to echo your point, though, it's
Carey Price, no. Carey Price won the best goalie in the American Hockey League with Hamilton.
Are you sure?
Oh, I am very sure. Yes, I am.
All right. I'll take your word for it. But to echo your point, though, yes, it's very few and far between of guys that are able to make that jump right away. And usually, even like with the Sergei Bobrovsky, you know, you at least have some pro experience over in Russia or something to that situation. So do you think that fan sentiment, you know, the clamoring for that franchise goalie, do you think that could get into Ron Hextall at all? And maybe he could make a move when the kid might not be ready or he's not 100% confident. You know, if Brian Elliott is struggling, let's say, and you got Carter Hart down the minors for maybe a month who looks really good, do you think that the fan pressure would get to Hextall?
Well, I don't think that's something that Ron Hextall runs on looking at what's happening now and won't panic if something in the short term as compared to the long term happens with his hockey club. Brian Elliott actually was very good last year until he got hurt. And you know, the backup could be anybody. I mean, Stolarz is healthy again. Well, he's not quite healthy yet, but Stolarz is back. I'm sorry. Stolarz is healthy again. Alex Lyon, I thought, played really well. And so Noivy is the question mark because Noivy's been so injury prone and you never know what you're going to get with him. So all those different questions will be answered in training camp. But right now, it's no different than what was said 2 years ago with these young defensemen. We're going to wait and see what happens, and then we will let them proceed through the system to make them the best possible players they can be when they get here. And I think that's what they're going to talk about with Carter Hart.
How surprised were you that Claude Giroux had the season he had last year?
Well, I think there's a couple of combinations. I think that Claude Giroux was probably fortunate enough to... No, I wouldn't even start like that. I'm going to say that Claude Giroux was the team guy he is when approached by going from center to left wing, because, first of all, anybody knows somebody that's played center and then all of a sudden thrown to the left side and having to play the wrong side, you go, are you kidding me? That can't believe he's going to do that. And he did an outstanding job of doing it. So he gives a lot, gets a lot of credit for that. But then when you add the emergence of Sean Couturier and what he did as the number one center of the Philadelphia Flyers, I think that had a lot to do with the success of Giroux too. So all those different things coming together certainly helped Couturier with a guy like Giroux on the wing, and it helped Giroux having Couturier in the middle.
Do you think the Flyers should have went after John Tavares?
No. Well, first of all, somebody wrote an article about that, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, they're going to write an article about something.
It's the dead period, but... That makes sense. John Tavares publicly came out and said he didn't want to come to Philadelphia. So, if you've got six teams that are on his list, he had a list that was issued to all the teams, and why would somebody think that that list meant nothing to somebody? I mean, that's just... That's not even worth talking about.
Look, Coatsy, I'm with you. I didn't think it made sense. I just felt like it would be wrong if I didn't at least ask it. I'm going to put you on the spot. It is mid-July, way too early prediction. How does this team do next year?
I've got the answer for that, Pat. Ask me at Christmas.
I could be fired by Christmas time, Coatsy. You know? I need an answer
now.
You
know what? There's so many different things. I mean, first of all, how do you make a prediction of a hockey team when you don't know what the hockey team's going to be?
That's why it's a way too early prediction.
That's exactly right. I think the hockey club would be a lot better. It'll be strong defensively. If the goaltenders can stay healthy, they'll be as competitive as anybody. I think we're going to be a better scoring team. We'll have a better power play. I think that the penalty kill has to be better. There's no two ways about that. And I think Ian Perrier will make sure that that happens. And I just think that this coaching staff is a very good coaching staff. And they've grown together too. And I think that having these years under their belt and having the group that we have, it's a good group, that a lot of things could come together that are going to be very positive because of the familiarity of everybody coming back. So I think there's a lot of good things to look at. But I think there's some question marks. Like I said, goaltending will be a question mark until proven different down the road. But I think that they're deep at goal, which is going to be a lot better than it has been in the past.
All right, Coatsy, you can obviously hear you next season when the games actually get played, not right now in July when you're hitting the links. I appreciate the time, and I look forward to hearing you game one.
Pat, always a pleasure. Great talking to you.
Hopefully you enjoyed that interview. I will look to get these up about once a week, depending on, scheduling and who gets back to me and who doesn't. Make sure to follow me on Twitter @Pat_Egan, and thank you so much for listening.